Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You are my guinea pigs, because I've never presented this before, and I really have no idea how long it's going to last, but I understand that we have to be out by 10 o'clock, and 20 minutes before that for a cup of coffee, so surely I can manage it a little bit earlier than that. Now, when I first started to prepare this little talk, I realised that 8th of September 1888, when this building was originally opened, was a little bit too late, and that it was necessary to go back to the early 1800s to give you a sort of a resume of what happened to the health of the people of Douglas about that time. Now, there was no hospital of any description, and due to the various friendly societies, the first medical dispensary in Douglas opened in Sand Street and Weld Road Hill area in 1824. Now, this was a dispensary without a building. It sounds rather strange, but nevertheless, the do-gooder leaders of the time decided that they had to do something about the poor, so they collected this money, and the funds for its maintenance were provided for by the medical men of the time, and they also gave their time and their knowledge free. And the first year, they presented a balance sheet which showed that they had seen 844 patients had been relieved. Now, I'm not quite sure what the relieved means there, whether it means that they've been helped or whether they'd actually had monetary gifts, I'm not sure. But they did 4,782 prescriptions. Now, if you only have 844, it means that the people had up to 40, four or five prescriptions each. Now, this period was about the time when the cholera arrived on the island, and eventually a special building was erected on the outskirts of the town to deal with this infection, and it was used in 1832. And again the following year, when there was a further outbreak, and in 1837, was again reopened for the treatment of other infectious cases. Now, Dr. H.R. Oswald was a very active doctor during this period, and he is credited as a doctor who said that there should be a hospital with beds. And one of the dispensaries which was established during 1839 was the Poor's House, and that's where we can have the lights out, Mr. Kelly, please, and we'll have a look at the first film. Now, that's right. Now, there's the Poor's House. Now, this house building is still in the Villiers Yard in Douglas. Now, why it has never been made a listed building, I won't know. It's a great pity, because if ever and whenever they pull the Villiers Hotel down, this building is due for destruction at the same time. Whether it could be removed, I'm not sure, but it's a great pity if it's going to go, because it was one of the first ever buildings where health was looked after on the island. About this time also, Nellie Brennan, who was a rather famous lady in the medical world, was working amongst the sick and the poor. And much has been written about this remarkable lady and about how she nursed the cholera patients. Nellie, the washerwoman, lived in Wesley Terrace, and the house is still there. And she was matron of the Poor's House and was transferred to the first hospital in Fort Street as its matron when it was first opened in 1850. Now, this one here, there is the original photograph of the hospital showing Douglas. This was found in old Mr. Froude's photographic box when the family were looking through it. And if we have the next one, Mr. Kelly, please. And there we are. That's a much better photograph of it. But due to the expertise of Percy Morrison, that picture there has been blown up about 50 times to give you the site. Now this is a remarkable building because it had water closets in the building and inside sanitation, which was one of the first houses in the island to do it. But of course at that time there was no sewage at all, no pipes to take it away. So consequently everything was dumped on the beach outside and waited for the next time to come in to wash it all away. And in 150 years we haven't progressed very far. The establishment of this hospital was mainly due to the efforts of certain benevolent ladies of the Douglas and the neighbourhood. In 1849, these ladies held a public sale of work, which raised the sum of £300. And because these ladies worked so hard, this aroused the interest of the townspeople of the need for such an institution. As a consequence, public meetings were held in the courthouse in September of 1849. It was resolved at this meeting that this general hospital should be established on a suitable site in or near to Douglas for the relief of the sick and poor throughout the island. And that the site was eventually purchased at the time. Records show that in the first year there were 224 cases of smallpox, of whom 33 had died. But in the accounts, as I found very interesting, they spent £2.17 and 4 pence was on soap and laundry for a whole year. But at the same time, they spent £6.17 and 8 pence on wine and porter. So hygiene came long way behind in the care of the cleanliness, but not of the soul. And there was to be no smoking in the hospital and no sex. So the records state. This hospital carried on until 1877, when it was decided that a larger building would be required. The committee were looking around for a piece of land to build on. But on the 27th of June 1848, there's a report that a Dr. Harrison Curtis opened a hospital at 19 Duke Street for the treatment of diseases of the ear and eye. There is no record as to how long the hospital stayed open, but in 1849 there's a report that a certain Dr. Harrison Curtis was imprisoned for debt. So we presume that he couldn't afford to keep his hospital going. So he finished up in prison. Now the committee in the meantime had placed an offer for the land where the Sefton Hotel now stands. But unknown to them, Henry Bloom Noble had also placed a bid for the same parcel of land. And he was successful in obtaining it. At about this time also, Rebecca Bloom Noble was found to be suffering from typhoid fever. There was no suitable hospital for her to be nursed in. So Henry Bloom Noble, having found out that the hospital committee wanted the Sefton site, which he had just bought, offered this land here at Crown Crellin's Hill on sufficient money to build a hospital. I'm not quite sure I believe Mr. Kelly the £5,000 because my figure was £10,000, but it is somewhere between £5,000 and £10,000, and we will take it as around about that sum. So the seed of the first Noble's Hospital and Dispensary was sown. The architects were Bleakley and Cubbon of Birkenhead. Yes, please. Now that is Cubbon's drawing of the hospital. It is in colour over here later on if you would like to have a look at the photographs. The original is in the boardroom at Noble's, and you know, when you look at it, they made a very good effort for that period of time, and it was a remarkable building. But the foundation stone, please. The foundation stone was laid by Rebecca Bloom Noble on the 26th of July 1886, and the hospital was formally opened by the Lieutenant Governor, Mr. Spencer Walpole, that was before he was knighted, on the 4th of September 1888. I went down to look at the foundation stone this evening, and it is covered up with plastic. I inquired from the staff whether they knew why it was covered up. And they thought that perhaps it was covered up because they're doing some alterations to the building and roundabout, and they've covered it up to so that it wouldn't get damaged. But somewhere on there, of course, Mr. Coven must be. He was a remarkable marksman, being responsible for building quite a lot of drawing up and planning various buildings on the island. Rebecca is actually laying that stone up. Having opened the hospital on the 4th of September 1888, the patients were eventually moved in January 1889 with much love and care on handcarts from Fort Street. So can you imagine them, sick people being trundled along on the cobblestones on handcarts to the new hospital? Yes, please. That is a picture of the partially completed complex. And then the next one, I think we shall find, is the actual opening ceremony by Mr. Walpole. He was later knighted for his work. Now, the total beds at that time were 45. There were two honorary physicians and two honorary surgeons, and the matron was a Miss Ransford. Nellie Brennan, of course, had transferred to the Fort Street Hospital as matron, but then she found that she couldn't carry on as it was too heavy for her, and she left it, and Miss Ransford was replaced her. The number of nurses and other ancillary workers cannot have been very many, because the total bill for wages in that first year only amounted to £50, 5 shillings and 8 pence, and that included all the staff with the exception of the matron. So, now these premises, as you now know, became the Manx Museum in 1922. I'll come to it in a moment. These premises had a short life, and it soon became apparent that they were too small due to the ever-growing demands. In 1895, Clifton House, which is across the road, was purchased and became the house for the nurses, or the nurses' home as we know it today. And some adjoining properties were bought in 1897 and 99. Henry Bloom Noble had died in 1903, leaving his estate in the hands of his trustees to administer for charitable purposes. But in his will, he specially commended them to the extensions of his hospital, not the people's, his hospital, Henry Bloom Noble's hospital, his hospital. And in 1906, there were many meetings and discussions about a new hospital or to alter the present one. Here, if you've got time afterwards, are the actual plans which were drawn up to alter this building and enlarge it. But these were drawn up in, I think, 1905. What was his name? A chap called Beaumont and Son of St. James's Square in Manchester. But when I was organising the 100 years of Noble's Hospital, Chapin came, knocked on my door. He said, I've got some plans here, perhaps you would like them. He said, I used to work for an architect in Athol Street and they were going to be destroyed. And so these are what he gave me, a complete set of plans for the refurbishment of this building. But as you know, of course, that it was never really altered here as a hospital, because there was a lot of discussions and arguments. I'm not going to go into it because it's a few pages long, but I will read a resolution here from the Bloom Noble trustees at the meeting at the Villa Marina on the 17th of October 1906. Noble's Hospital. The chairman, treasurer and secretaries met the trustees and discussed the financial aspect of the present and proposed new hospital as set forth in the chairman's letter received in August last. And it was resolved that the trustees should formally communicate to the hospital committee their inability to grant any further sums than that already offered, £40,000, and the proposed site on the Hills estate for the erection and endowment of a new hospital. and that if the hospital committee could not see their way to accept this offer, the only alternative the trustees could suggest was to carry out at the present hospital the alterations mentioned in Mr. Noble's will, with such further additions as might be deemed desirable, the trustees also providing an endowment to cover the present deficit of £400 per annum, and such further sums, if any, as the trustees might decide. There's a lot of difference between £400 and £40,000, but there are the arguments here, for and against, and the for's, the moving to the new site, the Greenfield site, were agreed 9-7. So it was pretty close at that time, and so the hospital eventually moved, and it was built. As a consequence of this resolution, the hospital committee took a vote on whether to move or not, and I say the very close, 9-7, agreeing to the move to the Hills Estate. By this time, Matron Brightson was in charge of the nursing staff and had been appointed in 1906, and she served the hospital until 1923, giving 17 years of service. When she retired, she was presented, awarded a retirement sufficient for her to live in comfort for the rest of her days by the hospital administrators. It's quite remarkable that they were given pensions in those days, but she was a very clever lady. Please. There's a photograph of her and some of her early staff. I couldn't possibly try and tell you who they all are there. They are at the bottom, they're all named at the bottom of the page, and as I say, if you want to see them all, they are in the folder here for afterwards. In 1911, the hospital treasurer noted in his annual report that the accounts were overdrawn to the tune of £800. Mr. H.R. Brown, the owner and editor of the Isle of Man Times, heard about this, and he raised a fund to pay off this debt, and on the 4th of May 1911, he presented a cheque to the trustees for that amount of money. I've got a copy of it over there as well, of the cheque and the receipt which he received from the hospitals. Next, please. Now, this is the medical staff at that time. Some of them are still famous Max names, and if I read them through, on the back row from the left is Jack James. He is the father of Jack James, the dentist now, and the uncle of Norman James, who was also the dentist. Dr. Rentoul, house surgeon, Dr. T.A. Woods in the middle here, Dr. Lionel Woods. Now, Lionel Woods, of course, was quite a remarkable chap. He served the hospital for 40 years, and eventually became the radiographer, the first radiographer. On the front row, we have Dr. Cordiner, assistant surgeon, my mother-in-law, who's an old lady. She remembered Dr. Cordiner when she was a young girl in Douglas. That's Charles Panton, Guy's father. He was one of the antes from moving from this building, because he, in the report here, remarked that Guy's Hospital managed to rebuild without moving their patients. Why can't we do it here? But there's another Woods, and in the corner we have Dr. McKenzie. Now, the new hospital, Noble's Hospital on Westmoreland Road, was opened by Lord Raglan on the 11th of September 1912. And Lord Raglan was a very autocratic gentleman, and he arrived dressed in all his Masonic regalia, with all the Masons of Douglas following him, and all the townspeople and anyone of any importance on the island, and they all paraded up from the Douglas Town Hall in a large retinue, and the actual opening ceremony and the handbook is on the table over there. Now, this hospital at the time had 57 beds and contained every department known to medicine at that time. But again, it was not long before additions were required. And These are a couple of photographs here of the outside of the hospital. Nurse Cottier, here again, she was a mine of information when I was drawing up the history and presenting, loaned me many, many photographs. She was 86 then, so it means she must be 90 now. But still very active and doesn't get out quite as much as she used to do. Next one. This is the, there you can see the hospital, which is very stunted ward blocks, but that was how it was in 1912. And these market gardens here almost grew enough food to feed the patients in the hospital. The private wing was built and opened in 1926. This added 12 beds. I was under the impression it was 12 beds, but I was informed today that it actually is 13 beds. So, but it again is still only 13 beds, and having existed there since 1926. This eased the pressure. The opening of the private ward eased the pressure on the public wards, and a special fund administered by the British Red Cross donated £500 towards the cost of building. Now, at that time, and until quite recently, this outpatient department here, outpatient block, the casualty, and the green tiles were still there until they were pulled down to make way for the new building in the 60s. That's Nurse Cottier there. With her sister McDonald, and they only difference was that there, of course, they had the gas pipes, but they put electricity in and a little bit of a few frillings, but they didn't really alter very much for 40 years. In 1927, the committee decided to spend £4,000 on an electromedical hall. We know that as X-ray department today. And Mrs. E.H. Cunningham, they're the Cunningham camp people, hearing of this new scheme, decided to donate sufficient funds to defray the cost in memory of her father and husband. This extension was opened in June 1928. And that also existed until into the 1960s, when they were all pulled down to make way for the new outpatients. At this time, the committee were discussing the possibility of building a maternity home. But difficulties with finance arose, and this idea was put on hold. The area of the ground for maternity home, was eventually taken over and used for building the nurses' home. This again eventually became Ward 11. In the meantime, the question of maternity home was filled by the private benefactor of Alderman A.B. Crookall, who built and endowed the Jane Crookall Maternity Home in memory of his wife. The Jane, as it is known, will soon disappear, it being transferred to the new Obstetrics and Gynecology Unit. And Dr. Guy has just published a history of the Jane Crookall, which are on sale in aid of hospice at the cost of £4.95 each. And I can assure you that it is a very well-prepared document to add to the histories of medicine on the island. In 1929, the demands for beds was increasing, and the committee decided upon another extension, the cost of which was not to exceed £20,000. Preparations were made to hold the Great Bazaar. The directors of the Isle of Man Bank heard about this and stepped in with a donation of £8,000. And on the strength of this gift, various other promises were made and smaller events held to raise funds. The Manx people have always been extremely generous when efforts have been made to raise funds for the hospital, and they soon raised this £20,000 for these alterations. The purpose of this building was to double the size of the main ward block, and whilst this building was underway, the need arose for the building of an orthopaedic ward. For many years, the committee knew about this need, to have a ward to treat orthopaedic tuberculosis, but the treatment of other orthopaedic cases was also increasing, so they decided that they would add to the plans the orthopaedic block. The X-ray department was revamped theatres, the orthopaedic block and the new extended ward blocks were inspected and opened by Prince George, later to become King George VI, please, on the 10th of June 1932. Ah, this is 1926. These are the, this is Matron Collister now. Matron Bryson had retired. And she was a great aunt to Sister Kringle, Matron Corteen, or later Betty Wilde, but they've also been associated for many, many years, that the family in Puck Nobles. I don't know all the names of the nurses, but perhaps some people could recognise aunts or cousins or whatever from that photograph. There we are. That is the portrait, or the rather the plaque, which is up in the X-ray department of Dr. Lionel Woods, and it was put up there when he was 40 years in the hospital staff as surgeon and radiologist. It was a very dangerous occupation, radiology, in the early days. He used to lose fingers and hands and various other parts of the body, but he was a very clever and very remarkable man. I still have his original table in my archives at Nobles, and the original X-ray lamp. I was only saying a little earlier, it's a pity I couldn't have brought some of the memorabilia with me, but I'm afraid they're a little bit cumbersome. And if you give them to the museum, you can't have them back again. They put them in their archives, and that's the way they have to stay. But I still have them at Nobles. Thank you. Now, there is an aerial view about 1924, and there you see the private wing. They still have the stunted ward blocks there, and the administration block. The roadway is still virtually the same. There's no buildings on Ballycomin Road or Westbourne and St. Catherine's Drive. The area here, of course, are the corporation houses, and those two have recently been purchased and pulled down by the hospital to make a car park. When the hospital was earlier, they had a generator to generate sufficient electricity for the X-ray machines, but this generator was now obsolete, and the committee decided to turned the building into a porter's lodge. And Alec Luthwaite, who was head porter there for many years, was moved into it, and after he left it, it became derelict and they pulled it down for later extensions. After all this building had taken place, there was about 2 acres of ground left for further extensions. The area of ground now down to the Peel Road had originally been part of the hospital estate, but it was sold to the Douglas Corporation in the early 1920s for a peppercorn, and how they wish they had it today. Little more was done up to and including the Second World War. The William and Emma Clegg Pathology Laboratory was added in 1938 at a cost of about £1,000, with an endowment of a further £1,000 per year. This one room has now been converted into the hospital pharmacy. In 1946, a special subcommittee was set up to consider the needs of the hospital and look into the future. I wonder whether they had a crystal ball to see into the future, because their report advised the increase in the number of beds, provide new operating theatres, enlarge and modernise the outpatient department, improve the accommodation for nurses, the kitchens and the dining area. Until 1948, the hospital had to rely on its own exertions and its power to attract gifts for the finance to maintain and improve the facilities. There was a penny in the pound scheme for the general public to pay into. And in 1948, before any steps could be taken to implement the committee's recommendations, the Isle of Man Health Services came into effect. Although Nobles retained its voluntary hospital status, the governing powers were placed under a statutory obligation to cooperate in provision of the health service under the National Health Service Isle of Man Act. Marathon Court, please. Oh, sorry. This is the opening of all these extensions by Prince George, and that is the orthopaedic block in 1932. Yeah. That is a view of the outside of the hospital from the front. This didn't change from its building in 1912 until in the middle 60s, when this portion here was pulled down and Ward 5 was pulled down to make way for the new outpatients department, please. And that is a view of the back of the hospital. The architects didn't really do a very good job there, because where the pointer is now was the boiler house, and those were the theatres. And here was a fan, an extractor fan. Sometimes it wasn't working and it went the other way, and the dust from the boiler house used to be drawn into the theatres. Little aside, I was lecturing to the nurses one day about cross-infections in the hospital, and the following day I came across the domestic cleaning her brush on the pebble dashing on this wall, and the wind was blowing in that direction and we're blowing all the dust back into the wards. So how cross-infection happened, that was one of the reasons anyway. Poor dear, I had to talk to her carefully, because one couldn't be too hard on her, because she wasn't terribly bright, and she didn't understand the questions of hygiene and cross-infections and whatever. But it really did happen. And then, of course, the orthopaedic ward was down this slope and just came at the end of here. Marathon Court was purchased and was the nurses' training school until 1952. It now, of course, is the Marathon Court Nursing Home, but it was a very nice building for the nurses' training school, because there was room there for the probationary nurses to live in if they wished to. It continued there until the nurses' home was opened in 1953. As a result of the new Act, how are we doing for time? Oh, we've had three quarters of that, we've had half an hour, so we're all right, yeah. In 1953, that's right. 1953, the nurses' home was completed and opened by His Excellency Sir Andrew Ambrose Flux Dundas. This project had been on the agenda for many years, and it was one of the projects taken over by the new board. And when I was doing the history, I was given a book of cuttings from out of the local papers, and there was a tremendous amount of hot air spilt in the quays and the Timwell chambers over the very high cost of consultancy fees. But it had been proved that before any other major buildings could be carried out, the nurses' home had to be built, and if it had not been done so, there was a grave danger that the hospital could have lost its nurse training status. This building was very little altered until 1990, when there was a swimming pool built in the area of the nurses' common room, and then the first floor was adapted to take the house doctors in 1991-92. At the same time, most of the windows have been double glazed, but having a nurses' home suitable, there were other extensions and additions it was necessary before the plans and estimates could be drawn up for the following extensions. There was a multi-purpose wing. The former nurses' home was to be the amenity beds in Ward 11, the new outpatients department in casualty, new central boiler station and the chronic sick wing. There should be a change there, I think. Yes, that's the time when the Reverend Fred was cutting the first sod for the building of the Cubbon Wing. In a later aerial photograph, you will see the Cubbon Wing, how it was built as a cross. It was dedicated to his father, and I actually have that spade now. It was rescued from the Derby junk after Fred's house on the head was taken over, and all the Derby junk people cleared it out, and that spade was found up at the Derby junk and given to me for our history. Now the necessary funds for all this building was voted by Timmald in July 1956. The plans were approved in 57, and the boiler house, which the first part was brought into operation in the winter of 1959. The multipurpose ward block was commenced with the twin theatre units in February 1958. And in today's paper, there is an application for planning permission for the new theatre block. So it hasn't lasted very long, really, from 58 up 35 years, which isn't really very long in the history of an island. That is the laying of the foundation stone for the nurses' home. And that building was actually started before permission had been granted and the funds being granted by Timmald. And again, there was still a lot more hot air spoken about why it had started and before permission had been granted. It was rather naughty of the builders and whoever was responsible, but it was being built when I came to the island in. I came in September of 1951. I'm afraid we got that one a little bit out of place, so we'll go on Mr. Kelly. Now this, the Princess Alexander Wing, was built and completed and opened in 1960. The isolation walls, which were just about here, the other side. The isolation walls were on the other side. They were eventually adapted to hold the intensive therapy unit, and the first one which we had on the island. I don't live very far away from the hospital, but I was called in one evening on the emergency, and Dr. Boyles rang up, and I was at my car in the road, and my wife called out to me, "You wanted an ITU, quickly." I jumped in the car, drove down to the hospital, pulled up outside ITU. Dr. Boyles was still talking to my wife on the phone. He says, "Where have you come from?" I said, "I've come from home." "Oh, well," he said, "we better sign off from your wife now and get on with the business." So, all these extensions were opened by Her Royal Highness Princess Alexandra of Kent on Wednesday the 9th of November 1960. She should be there somewhere too. There we are, there's a dear lady. And all the staff lined up in the main corridor of the hospital. And the most gracious lady, she walked through. I think she saw every single person assembled in the corridor that day. Now, access to the rear of the hospital was becoming necessary, and the new roadway was made possible through the cooperation, the Douglas Corporation, who generously conveyed a strip of land to the hospital trust trees free of charge, considering they only paid 25 pence for it. It wasn't too bad of them to give a little bit of it back again. Now in 1966, the William M. Clegg Laboratory were transferred to the old orthopaedic block. Pathology had advanced very rapidly during the previous 10 years, so after much discussion with the Health Service Board, it was agreed to adapt the old ward block. I well remember the architects, K.N. Gill, Wesley Gill in particular, arriving one day with the outline of the building and asked me to draw the various rooms we would require to bring it up to the standards we wanted. Having done all that, I thought I'd completed my task. The following day, Wesley Gill arrives again with a list of over 20 main items which would be required: positioning of electric points, lights, gas, and so on. And the end point was that we eventually arrived at a laboratory for once designed by the lab staff and had 92 electric sockets. And the very first day that it was opened, 92 was found to be inadequate, and we had to put extensions on for the next period. Before it moved, 22 years later, there were over 300 electric sockets and almost every single test was automated. When the Guy Penton laboratory was opened, it was in the opinion of experts sent over from the adjacent isle to be one of the finest pathology laboratories in the British Isles. 1966, please. Matron Corlett. Oh, there we are. That was the old lab. But we built out screens right along the front of the balcony to enlarge the rooms inside. On the day it was opened, please. On the day it was opened, as my daughter, that George Hodgkin's daughter, Mrs. Benton, Matron Ada, Mrs. Evan Kane, Mrs. Gill, daughter of the founders of the Clegg family, the bishop blessed, Bishop Gordon blessed the building and hoped for the health of others, but the senior Morris, the engineer and I had blessed it the night before because we scraped the floor and scrubbed it, and we finished about 12:30 cleaning the floor so that it would be suitable for opening on the following day. And Matron Corlett had, now I think we can go to Matron now. Oh, we'll have a look at the lab staff first. There's Dr. Guy, of course, and myself, Mr. Cayley, Pickett, Peter Kippendale, Mrs. Landon, Roy Cripps. He was one of the very few on the staff at any time that wasn't a Manxman. He came up from Oxford. Peter Whittle, the present chief, Ernie Corlett, George Hotchkiss, and so on. We were quite a rebellious lot, weren't we, Guy, one time or another? But and I came to the island, there was one other chap here who came up from London, but there were no Manx children had ever qualified in medical sciences. But before I retired, there were 47 children had passed their exams and were qualified in the science. So I was very pleased about that, and they presented me with an illuminated address, and you can all have your television sets and binoculars and whatever, but there's only one illuminated address, and that's yours. Mm-hmm. And I think it says something on it about 45 years devotion to the service of others. It was very good. That was done by the chappie who actually is the revives all the books down here, a chap called Craig. In the 19s, we'll get on to Matron Corlett now, I think. That's right. No, we won't. No, these are the blood donors. That's right. The St. John Ambulance, they were a tremendous help to the island, and still are, because they staff the blood donor sessions. I don't know all the ladies' names, but this is Evan Kane, and that's Stanley. What's his other name? I'm meeting quite regularly, not really, never called him Stanley. But they do the blood donors, and they travel around the island free. They give all their time free, and as a consequence, of course, they have saved the Health Service Board many tens of thousands of pounds by staffing all these blood donor sessions. When they first started in 1937-38, Dr. Dorothy was the first one to actually use blood in the Jane Crook Hall. And after I came, I happened to be O rhesus negative. And if you've heard about rhesus babies, well, they're not blue babies really, they're rather pink, but anyway, you probably know them as blue. But they have to have their blood changed. Remembering that I got married in December 1951, and in the March of 1952, my wife was walking in Union Mills with her aunt, and the lady said, "Oh, yes, Mrs. Sherrett, yes, this is your husband's baby." So, remembering I've only been married 3 months, and she said, not quite that, but when the baby was born, she was a rhesus baby, and we used, and your husband's blood was used to change her blood and enable her to live happily. So, It's nice, but it was rather embarrassing just for a few minutes, of course, when that was found. I really now think it's Matron Corlett. There she is, yes. Dear old soul, Matron Ada. In 1966, she had completed 40 years' service to nobles, broken only by a short stay in Liverpool to take further examinations. She served the hospital in every phase of nursing, starting as a probationer and a qualified nurse, staff nurse, sister in outpatients, and later sister in the private wing. She was deputy matron, and finally as matron, and retired a much-loved and competent character. She was followed as matron by Matron Courtine, who also served the hospital for many years, coming up through the ranks, and for a spell nursed and taught in Barrow. She came back as sister tutor and eventually became matron. She wrote an obituary to the Nurses Training School in the Isle of Man, the Examiner, in February of this year, when the Royal College withdrew their training certificate. It had been fought over since 1924 to keep up to date, but I'm afraid the modern idea of thinking, and they've lost their way a little bit. Whether the nurses' training will ever come back again to the island is a matter for conjecture. We hope someday that it will do. Royal College, please. In 1969, the Royal College was 50 years old, and this anniversary dinner was held in Douglas, when members of the Medical Profession and Managing Committee joined in the celebrations. Amongst those in the photo are Eric Vernon, right in the back corner there, Mrs. Panton, Mrs. Ferguson, Dr. Guy, Sister Rina, I don't know that one, he's one of the doctors, Mrs. Evan Kane, Matron Corlett, Clive Rock and his wife. The head there, pointing over the top, is Mary McCarty, Miss Fletcher, Norman James, the dentist, and Daddy McPherson, and I'm sorry about Daddy Mac, but he's always known as Daddy Mac, Dr. McPherson, and Ada Courtine here in the corner. The next development was the 19... 19-